Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, thanks for coming and thanks for listening. Now, this obviously looks a little bit like an inside job because the author of the book we're about to talk about is, in fact, the co-presenter of Word in Your Ear. So a very tough negotiation, quite a difficult business to persuade him to do this. But let me first introduce our august panel who are here to help us discuss this book. And we have the fantastic writer and broadcaster and former member of the Word magazine team, Jude Rogers.
Sorry.
Please give her a warm welcome, who you will, I'm sure, recognise from the portrait painted of her by Chrissy Hynde that appeared in The Observer this weekend. And we also have the equally fantastic broadcaster and fellow Beatles obsessive, Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Now, the title of the book is Nothing Is Real, and it's subtitled Why the Beatles Were Underrated and Other Sweeping Statements About Pop, and has various compelling theories. It's all about the drummer, why 60s rock stars never give up, seven things I would tell a young band, a cautionary tale, why some acts don't make it, music that you should, or more importantly, shouldn't play at weddings and funerals. Those two theories we are going to discuss this evening, along with some other theories from this book, and theories from the panel. But the problem for me is that I've known the author of this book for 41 years, and I have never won an argument with him. So, you know, what we call theories, he calls facts. So, yeah, please welcome your very own David Hepworth.
Hey!
Yeah. Well, Dave,
it's thrilling to be here, Mark.
We're both rather out of our comfort zone. We've switched sides.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I normally I'm hidden behind Mark's vast presence.
Now, this book, you've had two books out already, 1971, and you've had Uncommon People. I heard you on the Danny Baker Show the weekend. Very, very energetic. A performance it was too, and
I managed to snap Danny out of his customary torpor.
The torpor, and woke him up. Yeah, but you said that you described the first two books as being 1971 and Uncommon People as being like LPs, and this being like a 10-inch album.
This is a 10-inch.
So what did you mean by this? Is it not a greatest hits? It's a 10-inch album.
I suppose there's a series of, the first book, Never a Dull Moment about 1971, second book, Uncommon People, The Rise and Fall of the Rockstar. And then the third book is actually coming out fourth. It's coming out next year. It'll be a book about something else. But this is a bit of a staging post, I suppose, and it's a combination of loads of different stuff. It's some stuff that may be completely new to you, unless you're in the habit of listening to Radio 3 late at night, which I fancy you're probably not, Mark, and many people aren't, because I did a number of essays for Radio 3, and God bless Radio 3, because they are one of the few places in British broadcasting where they will let you just, have an essay and a written piece that you then read, and it's 14 minutes long or something like that. And so that's where the title of the book, Nothing Is Real, comes from, because a lot of those are about the subject of kind of authenticity in pop music. And then there's some stuff that originally appeared in Word and has been reworked. And then there's some stuff that's completely fresh. For instance, there's Everything I Know About Rock TV, which I'm sure you'll be enthralled to read as well.
I looked in the index to see if my name appeared. You
know. Absolutely. And it's very interesting that this should come out this week of all weeks, because I'm told, although I haven't seen it myself, that I actually appear, played by an actor, in the Freddie Mercury film.
No.
You do. Yes. A guy apparently looks exactly like Timmy Mallett.
He has enormous.
You
spectacles.
Had to say that.
Yeah. They didn't approach me to see if it's okay, but so apparently.
Do you have a speaking part?
I don't believe so. No. Apparently, somebody looks sitting there looking puzzled next to Bob Geld, next to the actor playing Bob Geldof, as he kind of bangs the table and demands money. And so, at least, if you buy my book, Nothing Is Real, you get the proper story,
the real story
of what actually happened.
And what Bob Geldof actually said.
And what Bob Geldof actually said, which is not what everybody...
Not what everyone thinks he
said. Not what every cab driver in the world tells me he said.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Absolutely.
So that's a kind of an idea of the range of stuff.
And there's some stuff from a couple of pieces from Word magazine, I think.
There is. Yeah, there's a piece I wrote about the blues.
Yeah.
In there, I can't remember. There's other short things, but there's also the kind of essay column, whatever you want to call it, that kind of starts off the book, which is my favourite theory, which is the Beatles were underrated.
Let's start on that. Yes. Yeah, so give us some idea why you think that's true.
I mean that kind of is one of those things that started in the Word office, and this will be familiar to Jews.
Yes.
People in the Word office. You know, I'm thinking about obviously myself and the people like Andrew Harrison. We know we're not kind of backward in coming forward in saying, I think you'll find that the greatest record ever made is whatever it is.
It's very hard to work there sometimes. You just sat back, Mark would go, right, I've got a story for you. We'd all push our chairs back, feet on the table, and just, you know, bask in it, really.
So, and one of the things people did was present the idea. They always presented subjective ideas as objective facts, which I always really warmed to
love that
idea.
People would say, I know what the greatest record in the world is. You said, no, I know this one. I know this. Don't tell me. I know it.
And as if there is only one answer, which is brilliant. Yeah.
So I wrote a piece for Word, which was a very popular piece, I think, which was, you know, my theory why the Beatles were underrated. And I think it started as one of those columns that you write, you know, you have to write under pressure. You've got to turn out 800 words by the following morning. So you better have an idea, and you better be able to stand it up. And it's one of those ideas that the more I've thought about it in the years since, the more right I think I am. You'll be surprised to hear. And I want to just tell you a brief story. There's a guy that Mark and I both used to work with years ago called Dominic Smith. And Dominic is significantly younger than us. And, you know, so he's more of the generation of kind of, I don't know, Oasis and Blur and so forth. And I never forgot this. Years ago, he said to me, I think I'm going to buy a Beatles record. He thought, oh, steady on, Dom.
They might just catch on.
And so he, you know, I saw him after the weekend. I said, Dom, did you buy a Beatles record? He said, yes. He said, I didn't like it very much. And I thought, I said, Dom, did you buy Let It Be? He said, yes. How did you know? And I said, I know because you picked the record whose cover has them looking most like members of Oasis. And I think this is really, you know, I think it's quite a significant point because I think the Beatles, you know, we kind of relaunched a number of times. Obviously, after the death of John Lennon, they were relaunched. And then they were kind of relaunched in the 90s with the anthologies and all that kind of stuff. And that was around about the same time as Britpop. And I think for many people, they emerged from out of that strange, confusing moment as being a slightly superior version of Blur, which I can't help but think is rather underselling them, you know.
Slightly. So grotesquely disrespectful.
And if you have the idea that there is that theory that in show business generally, you've only got 3 years. You can spin it out a bit longer, but 3 years is what you've got. Keeping your inspiration bright. And so the Beatles had 2 3-year careers. 3 years as lovable mop tops singing songs about teen romance in the face of a hail of jelly babies and screams. And then 3 years as drug-taking psychedelic adventurers. And I think the bit of the Beatles that we're most comfortable with nowadays is the psychedelic adventurers. We think that's all fine. That's all very Six music. That's all very later with Jules Holland. We can understand that. It's Friday night, you know, BBC Four. Yeah. What we don't understand, and what, of course, because of my great age, I remember, because I was 13 when all this happened, was the Beatles were a load of things that were wonderful that are now unfashionable. And so we don't recognise them sufficiently. For instance, you're going to ask me, Mark.
For instance?
They were a covers band. You know, they were, I would argue, the best wedding band that never played a wedding for anybody ever. Because they could command a range of material. They could do something for the old people, something sentimental, something comical, you know, something raucous and rocking. They could do all
Which
that stuff.
They did
stuff.
The Royal Variety performances.
Absolutely.
That's what they did, actually. Yeah.
They also, I remember, they used to turn up and croon with Morecambe and Wise.
Yeah.
You know, all those things that bands of that kind of credibility, whatever, of which more later, nobody would dream of doing that nowadays. Yeah. The Beatles did that. They were completely in the mainstream of popular entertainment. They weren't alternative or anything like that. And also, I think they projected a quality that we're uncomfortable with nowadays, and that quality was happiness. I can remember this so clearly. I was talking to somebody about it today. You know, I was talking to somebody on the podcast, and I had to pick a Beatles record, and I had to pick With the Beatles. And to think that they made With the Beatles in between She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand is just absolutely astonishing. And I can remember hearing I Want to Hold Your Hand on Thank Your Lucky Stars. So this is 1963 Christmas, is it? Something like that. And you thought you were almost going to cry with happiness. Just the sound of them, you know what I mean? The invigorating, extraordinary kind of benign energy that they put out during that time when they were going at it too fast to think whether it was a good idea. Nobody was having second thoughts. They were just getting on with doing what they were doing. And I think that side of the Beatles is what we underestimate now. We underrate it. And if anything, we overrate the White Album.
Yeah.
And I think this applies to popular music generally. That we have a habit of taking people as seriously as they appear to take themselves. And so if bands are kind of chin-stroking and, you know, we tend to think that they have profound ideas. ABBA, we tend to think they don't have profound ideas at all. How do we know? You know what I mean? One is, you know, projecting happiness.
But things are very tilted against people who deal in happiness. It's considered to be superficial, isn't it?
I think so.
And they don't get enough credit for it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that applies right across entertainment. Yeah. Isn't it? It applies with comedy. You know, what's the greatest compliment you can pay anybody nowadays? And there's a piece about that, this in the book also, is people say things are dark and edgy. You know, that's the best thing you can say about anything. Why is that so great? Well, generally, because the person saying it is 45 years old and feels that the only way they can justify their continued interest in something that they liked when they were 14 is to suggest it's somehow mature. It's not necessarily.
But if they said that it made them feel wonderful, it would look ridiculous.
It wouldn't look
fashionable.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, true.
So, you know, that's the core of my point about the Beatles. That, you know, it's the early... It's Mop Tops Ahoy, you know, as far as I'm concerned. You know, that's where the joy of the Beatles is.
Yeah.
And I think if we lose our appreciation of that, you know, I think if you're too cool for that, you're too cool. And, you know, I think there's a danger of these things being kind of distorted in memory, you know what I mean? Because, and I suppose this happens to all pop music nowadays, is it all gets appreciated in retrospect. It's not to do with the time anymore, is it? You know what I mean? That the big audience gets to know about all this stuff years after it's happened.
I think there are some people who are appreciated now, like, say, Robin, the Scandinavian pop star. But actually, she's got a new York record. I've had great reviews. But that is actually about her being grown up and being much more mature and talking about grief and stuff. But I think her other records are a little bit more appreciated. I think because maybe a lot of the critics are, you know, a certain age and just aren't espouse the idea as you do that, you know, pop is great. There's nothing wrong with liking pop. I think that tide is turning. You know, ABBA absolutely have had, you know, since probably an amazing piece of Paul Denoyer wrote in a very early edition of Word about how ABBA should be reclaimed as this brilliant band full of songs that have profound ideas in them. You know, they sing about, you know, even before we get to The Visitors, where they all look very dark and edgy on the album cover, you've got Knowing Me, Knowing You, which is really sad and depressing. But through this beautiful, bouncy pop music, you know, you've got this stuff going on.
Where do you stand on the idea that the Beatles are underrated?
I agree, sadly. There's some things later on I don't agree with Dave. But I thought I'd look online to see if there are any lists of worst Beatles songs. And I found, this is why I've got my notebook, because my memory is terrible, Ultimate Classic Rock, I'm sure it's a fantastic magazine, whatever, I'm not against them, have a list of the Beatles albums in order of greatness. So a bit like those conversations we used to have in the Word office. But the songs at the end, at the bottom of the pile, are the early ones. They're the covers. You know, they were doing a cover. They were an amazing covers band.
Absolutely.
You know, this is the Beatles stuff that actually I play a lot now at home, because I've got a little boy who's 4.5 who thinks All My Loving is the greatest song in the world.
And he's right.
He probably is, yeah. I do feel, though, kind of sitting next to Jeff Lloyd, I think I should pass the floor to him, really.
But I can't believe there's a list of worst Beatles songs, because there is only one bad Beatles song.
Oh, go on.
Piggies.
Oh, no, I Dig a Pony.
No, nothing wrong with I Dig a Pony.
And Love Me Do isn't very good, but Piggies is rotten. Actually.
Yeah, Piggies is awful.
I Dig a Pony.
But Mr. Moonlight, people always talk about that as being the terrible Beatles song, but it's great being able to hear John Lennon's voice a cappella at the beginning of it, before the sort of Blackpool Tower organ kicks in.
That's right.
I think just his voice sounds really good on that intro.
Do you want to know some more from this list?
Yeah.
Till There Was You. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, nothing wrong with that at all.
Don't Bother Me. You know, kind of George got better writing songs. It's it. Your Mother Should Know. I'm sorry. That is fantastic in the way it harmonises. They harmonise in that.
And that scene from Magical Mystery Tour as they descend the staircase.
Yeah, fantastic. With the girls at the end of that, my 4.5-year-old is definitely heterosexual because he loves that bit the best. my relationship with the Beatles is quite funny because I did a GCSE in music and I did NA level in music. I've got grade 8 in violin, so all this kind of musical training and technique, whatever, that I don't write about ever, because you don't do that in music journalism quite rightly. But one of my set texts for my music GCSE was the Help album. And we had to, you know, analyse, you know, how their music was put together. But I had a really good teacher who said, you know, they weren't musically trained. They didn't, you know, Paul McCartney couldn't, you know, write on the stave or whatever. But they had, you know, I learned at that age that they'd had this, you know, seven years of playing together. When did they start playing together? 57?
Yeah.
Thank you. But they'd kind of absorbed so many different influences from different bands they were covering and styles they were taking in, and Paul's love of his father's record collection and all these stuff. So this learning about music has so ingrained it. So even though I was learning about, you know, the blues notes they put in here and the unusual way they harmonise on this particular track, it was really nice to think, this is just soaked into them because of their love of it and their learning.
Jeff, do you think there's anything that's underappreciated about them?
Yeah, I genuinely think it's impossible to overrate the Beatles. You know, unless you start talking about them as the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse or, that kind of thing. I think, you know, there's just brilliance in all those records. And I also think when you talk about a song like I Want to Hold Your Hand as being exuberant pop, which is definitely part of it, there's definitely, you know, it's bottled joy. But I also think sort of at the time it didn't sound like anything else either. No. So it's they were still inventive when they were making records like that. I'm not going to do this justice, but somebody of a certain vintage talked to me about hearing the Beatles for the first time, and he was into his music. And his kind of thing was music went dum 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 before the Beatles, and then when the Beatles come along, it goes da 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 da. And that's kind of the difference, sort of straight off the bat that you hear on that first album.
I know who does overrate the Beatles. The people who think the Beatles are overrated are Liverpudlians of a certain generation. And this is not all of them. Andrew Harrison, somebody who grew up in Liverpool and basically was sick to the back teeth of the Beatles. John Doran, who heads the Quietus, hates the Beatles. I'm like, come on, you can't hate the Beatles. But I think it's because...
It's just the position that people take up, isn't it, to draw attention to
But I think it's also...
It's not possible today.
I think it's growing up in Liverpool at a certain time. And, you know, their Liverpudlian bands were, you know, the early 80s scene, really. So it's almost a reaction against... That idea, and they have this idea of these. It is a kind of mop-top idea of the Beatles that they have as well. But yeah, if Andrew was here, he could.
I have every sympathy for people who want to rip up the generation's music that comes before them at the time. But it's still in this day and age they're saying, "Oh, the Beatles, shit, they were just a boy band." What's wrong
Good
with
boy
you?
Band,
yeah.
The thing that really strikes me is the way they always went the extra mile. I mean, I've been listening to them now for 50 years, wherever it is, and you still find these little tiny levels and layers of detail.
Yeah.
You know, you listen to Happiness is a Warm Gun, and the way they spent 15 hours recording this, 95 takes to get this impossibly difficult time signatures to work together, to create music that was as eerie and destabilising as the lyric, you know, and they really felt it was worth seeing. George and Paul's favourite track on the White Album, you know. I'm listening to, you know, Penny Lane the other day. I worked out it's actually a four-act play, you know. The first act, you meet the barber, then you meet the banker in the second, and the third is the fireman, and then all three of them get together in the fourth one with the girl selling the poppies, you know. And you know, those kind of extraordinary levels that they went to produce that extra you know, invention and creativity.
And just
that
they kept changing it up as well. They never thought, oh, this is what we sound like, and this is how we do it.
Well, so She's Leaving Home is another one. It's like a documentary. You know, She's Leaving Home, it struck me, you've got the voice of the narrator telling you the story, you've got the camera view from the point of view of the girl leaving the note and slipping out at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then you've got little interviews, little talking heads with the parents who come in and say, what did we do that was wrong? We've worked hard all our lives, etc. And the detail is absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
I think people get so used to hearing the Beatles all the time, you know, especially when you're in your child or in your teens. If you're of my generation, I'm 40 now, that you can get to a point where I think I was probably a bit bored of the Beatles because I thought I'd heard them all. I've got to say, Jeff's amazing show, Beatles Brunch, on Absolute Radio, which I used to was a kind of institution in my house. Dan and I used to put it on. My husband and I used to put it on every Sunday morning, and just listen to it. And just listening to, you know, it's not like the Beatles on shuffle because it was curated, obviously, but kind of just listening to all these different moments, organised in a different way, going, oh, my God. Yeah, they were fantastic.
That it's the same band doing that stuff. It's mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, we're agreeing too much, though, aren't we? It's not really good.
Well, let's move on to Mark. We're going to move on to another theory.
This is Mark's theory.
It's my theory, actually. Oh, right. She's that Bob Dylan's girlfriend changed pop music.
Yeah, go on, tell us, Mark.
Give me a couple of things. Now, it goes like this, that in July 1961... Dylan, who was 20 at the time, played a concert in Harlem in a church on a live radio broadcast. And he met afterwards the 18-year-old Susie Rotello. And there's a lovely bit in Chronicles where he talks about, you know, he's instantly in love. You know, the air was full of banana leaves. You know, she's like a Rodin sculpture come to life. And it's just wonderful. And he was a boy from Minnesota. He'd never met a girl like this. Incredibly hip, incredibly urban, marched and campaigned against for nuclear disarmament. She campaigned for racial equality. She'd been to Cuba, communist Cuba. Her parents were US Communist Party members. And, you know, up till the point he'd met her, he was playing traditional blues and folk and Woody Guthrie and Jesse Fuller songs. And when he met her and started writing, had a three-year relationship. She's the girl who appears on the cover of Freewheeling Bob Dylan. He then wrote, you know, Blowing in the Wind, Masters of War, Hard Rain, God on Our Side, Times They Are Changing, Hardship and Civil Rights Songs, Oxford Town, North Country Blues, Hollis Brown, Hattie Carroll. Now, he wasn't the first protest singer, but he was the first to take that into the mainstream, and that's the reason that he was signed up to play on the Washington rally with Martin Luther King. And that image of Dylan's, the folk protest player, the acoustic guitar and the harmonica, became so international that it became a symbol of how pop music was capable of a deeper purpose, you know, of something beyond entertainment. You know, that's why he was booked as the final act on Bangladesh. So, that's why he was, you know, that became the blueprint for Live Aid. And I think that...
And people still talk about it now, don't they? So when's he going to get back to writing?
And he wrote that
when he meets another 18-year-old girl.
Yeah, he wrote that handful of songs. I interviewed Roger McGuinn, who was a big friend of theirs at the time, Roger McGuinn said that at that time, he said, Dylan had done it because he was inspired by her, but also because he wanted to impress her. He wanted her approval. So the implication being he would never have written those songs if he hadn't been going out with Susie Rotello. And I think she deserves some credit.
Absolutely.
I think that's an astonishing thing. It's changed our view of pop music. Pop music is now something that's capable of altering the way people think. It's not just entertainment. You know, it could change the world. And I think that's largely to do with that girl.
I think it's probably
that's my theory.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of people who have written music because of girls, because of a significant woman in their life.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Not on the same level as Bob Dylan, but I just thought about, you know, the band Suede. You know, just Brett Anderson will, you know, basically Justine Frischmann was in his band, she left. He was so upset about this. He was like, I'm going to make this band really, really good and write different songs and do all this stuff. And that's when Suede became the Suede people know. You know, it's a different sort of impetus, but it was a girl at the heart of it.
There's additional significance in this in that's probably his best-known album cover, isn't it?
Yeah, because
that's a bit of theatre, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not just, I've got a girlfriend. It's, I've got a girlfriend who's going to be on the cover of my album. And they were. I read an old interview with her. Because she just died a few years ago.
She did, yeah.
And she said it was an incredibly snowy day. It was really cold. She's bundled up. She's got a coat on. She's holding on to him because she's cold. He's wearing a very thin suede jacket. Mm. He was shivering, but she said image was absolutely everything.
And she's looking at you, isn't she, as well? She's looking at you going, look what I've got.
I suppose so.
Also incredible that the record company allowed him to be on the cover with his girlfriend, because you had to look available, didn't you?
Right.
So it's pretty astonishing that they didn't do that.
I suppose so, but it established that image. And then, of course, it was all over within 6 months, wasn't it, or something like that?
Well, the relationship... No, it's kind of on and off for 3 years before he slipped off with Joan Baez, which went down very badly. And, of course, her mum and sister absolutely detested it.
And he wrote a song, Ballad in Plain D, which is the most appalling piece of character assassination of in musical form that you'll ever hear.
Which he does regret, though.
Does he?
Yeah. But then how would you feel if your daughter brought home a pop star and said, I'm going out with an aspiring pop star? I mean, it's going to lead to misery, surely, is going to be the outcome.
Knowing what I know about aspiring pop stars, I would be horrified.
Yeah.
Frankly, because quite simply, they are utterly career-obsessed.
Yeah.
As he was, wasn't he? Because she was cast aside quite soon afterwards when he got Joan Baez and it was something else. He wanted to move on. She was immensely useful to him at the time.
But you could argue that you have to be career obsessed in order to be successful.
I would.
If you don't concentrate on 150%, you're not going to make it, are you?
How would you feel, Jude, if your son came home and said, my girlfriend, she's got a session on Six Music.
My husband is in a couple of bands, so I'm sort of that girl. You know, a couple of bands that, you know, by any kind of terms are, you know, unsuccessful. But, you know, he's been in one band who they were playlisted on Six Music. They went on a tour. It was very exciting. This is when our son was a little baby, so his timing was a bit off. But he does other stuff. He, you know, we pay the mortgage, it's fine. But, yeah, I think, yeah, if he did come... Yeah, I've met enough of them now.
I think I'd be more concerned if my son wanted to be a musician than if he was dating one.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah.
Do you not think anything where your sense of self-worth is so reliant on what an audience thinks of you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah. As opposed to broadcasting.
Yeah. I don't want him to do that either.
No broadcaster ever looks at their ratings and thinks, my God, I'm becoming less popular, you know, I should worry about it. But look, another theory, this is from Dave's book, is that, well, it's the title of the book, actually, is that nothing in pop is real.
Well, yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, this started, obviously, the title of the book comes from John Lennon's line in Strawberry Fields Forever. You know, nothing is real. And it just struck me that popular music is almost alone among the arts, if we can call it that, is utterly obsessed with whether things are real or not. Because our interest in music, you know, kind of rock music, is different from jazz music and classical music in that you simultaneously kind of appreciate the music and also you make some judgment about whether the musician is worthy of your kind of loyalty, worthy of getting behind them. And if you trace this idea back, you know, a good example of where it starts is Leadbelly. We're looking at a picture of there. So Leadbelly is discovered by John Lomax, the folklorist, who's going round America in the 30s and the 40s, trying to record what he sees as real music. And real music, he thinks, can only be played by real people, i.e. not professional entertainers. He doesn't think Broadway music is real music. He thinks that stuff's driving out real music because radio has come along and is poisoning the well. And so when Leadbelly comes out of... He records Leadbelly in Angola Penitentiary. And when Leadbelly, who was serving time for murder, eventually comes out, he contacts John Lomax and he tours with John Lomax, doing kind of almost live demonstrations of folkloric art, you know. And he's treated in all the papers as he goes along as... a huge part of his appeal is he's real. He's a real murderer. Come and be in a room with a real murderer while he sings some music.
So this is, he makes records between homicides or something.
Yes,
that's right.
And obviously Lomax, he wasn't necessarily kind of obsessed with making a lot of money, but he was trying to make a living. This is what he what he realized about Leadbelly is that somebody who comes from a really kind of underprivileged background, a really violent past and so forth, is immensely enthralling to people who don't come from that kind of background. So he was doing his demonstrations to kind of rooms full of quite comfortably off white academics, you know, and they liked the idea of a prisoner being in their midst. And Lomax continued doing this throughout his career. There's a fascinating recording of him in a hotel room in Georgia with Blind Willie McTell. And he's getting Blind Willie to pretty much sing him all his songs. And you can hear them talking in between performances. And Lomax keeps going, "Have you got any complaining songs?" And Blind Willie kind of pretends he doesn't know what he's talking about. He says, "You know, songs about, you know, how hard the white man treats the Negro and all this kind of stuff." And Blind Willie just is not having any. And actually, instead plays him his new composition, which is a song about Edward the VII and Mrs. Simpson. So
toe-tapping hit.
Well, you know, but it's the idea that kind of, you know, John Lomax has gone in there looking for a certain kind of music, you know. And what he found is a lot of these guys, they played all kinds of music, you know, and they were quite keen on all kinds of music. And so, you know, this is just a very strong idea, isn't it? And Bob Dylan, who we've talked about already, you know, if you look at the way Bob Dylan presented himself on those early albums, particularly on the covers, he presented himself as a kind of son of the soil, as a working man. You know, he didn't present himself like Tony Bennett or Frank Sinatra or anybody like that. And it fascinates me because, you know, what has Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen and John Lennon got in common? None of them ever did a hand's turn of work in their lives. Yeah. Their whole careers were dedicated to avoiding doing anything that the working man ever had to do. You know, I know more about, you know, you've worked on the Christmas Post. Yeah. You probably know about more about the working man's life than Bruce Springsteen, you know. He got it all from John Steinbeck, you know. Yeah. So, you know, it fascinates me, that whole idea that people like the idea of pop music being real. And the Nirvana Unplugged thing, which is from when, I suppose, in the 90s, isn't it? 93. It struck me... When is it, Jude? 93.
I love that.
Unplugged. I like that record. But Unplugged, the whole idea of Unplugged is further evidence of our obsession with, is it real? Let's take all these groups who were really like, with all their equipment and their dancers and their lights, and let's take it all away.
It's interesting. I am many things. I am also the folk correspondent for The Guardian. That's how cool I am. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey, guys. Which has been an interesting gig. I do a monthly column, and I'm somebody who, you know, loves techno. I love crazy electronic music. I love Bananarama. You know, I'm not your traditional folk person. I think there might be people in that community who I think, you know, who's this young upstart doing this column. But I heard Dave's Radio 3 essay about Leadbelly, and I wasn't aware of this. It's so interesting. What I find is, you know, you think of the titans of folk music, Ewan McCall. He wasn't called Ewan McCall. That was a persona. The finger in the ear thing was a bit of him developing a persona. The critics group who surrounded him was developing a persona. You also get people like the singer Shirley Collins, who I love. And she is all about, you know, you sing as plainly as possible to get the stories across. And I get that. You know, you want to get these old songs to be delivered to a new audience in a new way. But she's not against, you know, young people maybe singing it in their own accents or doing things like that. But it's interesting when the people like John Lomax and Ewan McCall kind of...
Don't you wonder sometimes if people like Bob Dylan and maybe Ewan McCall or you know, Iggy Pop or Bowie would have ever had any success if the internet had been around at the time? Because they would say, yeah. I am this amazing creation. We go, no, you're not. There's a picture of you at school.
Yeah,
that's not your name, you know.
That's true.
I don't know, but we have a... Don't we? We have a belief. We a desire to believe in things that are often completely manufactured.
Like, I think when you're younger, it really matters, and then
yeah.
The older you get, the more you realise it's completely unimportant. Think about Iggy Pop. There must be days when Iggy Pop is about to go on stage and he thinks, "Oh, I really don't want to bleed today." Really like to not have to apply plasters after the gig. And yeah. it's just a bit of theatrics, isn't it? Sometimes. I mean, sometimes I'm sure he's in the moment and that's how he's experiencing that gig. But I'm sure a lot of the time it's like, well, here we go again. This is what people want to see.
Yeah. Bob Dylan doesn't care anymore, does he? You know, it's interesting that... You know, people got so angry when that Christmas record came out. How dare he make, you know, do a video dressed as Father Christmas? I love Must Be Santa. It's great.
I do. I like that. I like it as well. But Bob Dylan is a really interesting case of this because Joni Mitchell said, interviewed him about 10 years ago, and they were talking about the difficulty of continuing to make music in a 70s, 60s, whatever. And she said, it's all right for Bob, but he has that guy to sing the songs for him. And so what she meant was that Bob Dylan invented Bob Dylan
as
a character
.
In about 1962, and he's done it ever since. Mm. You know, it's like Marlon Brando invented a persona. Yeah. Jack Nicholson has been that character in every film since Easy Rider, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I should mention something that Dave and I were talking about earlier, which is I got a tweet last night, or was it the night before? I texted you about it. I wrote a blog in 2007 when I was just early stages of freelancing for The Guardian, who I still write for, about how Jeff Buckley was overrated. Admittedly, the column was slightly... I was trying to be a bit provocative, a bit edgy, as you'd say. But most of the piece is saying I saw him at Glastonbury at the age of 17 and I fell in love, you know, as 17-year-old girls do, with musicians. But, you know, after, you know, going through his music, you know, there's a lot of it that's overrated, it's overblown. He really created a persona and all this kind of stuff. Admittedly, this was published like the anniversary of his death, which is probably not the right time to do it. And I do regret that. I still get tweets in the middle of the night, American time, from really angry, sensitive, authentic men. And they always refer to Jeff... You know, as if he's their friend. I had a tweet, your whack-ass article about Jeff Buckley, you know, your cursed collection of words. It's there in the internet from the other night. I always plan to say, I wish I'd written this bloody article, you know. I say he's good in it. I say he's good in it, but, you know...
But maybe the only thing that matters is...
And then I don't reply ever anymore because that way madness lies.
maybe all that matters is people's reaction to this stuff is real. I mean, you may be looking at all live performances is a kind of fiction. Isn't
Jeff
it?
Was real, though. He had a song called So Real. He was really real.
He was really real. That's really real.
Yeah.
Well, Bruce Springsteen.
And he died, obviously, young, you make which the point adds
well,
to
he
that.
Died.
The yeah. Bruce Springsteen, you know, it takes as much trouble to kind of dress down and be a kind of
well,
regular
the point I
guy.
Made, the contrast with Beyonce and Bruce Springsteen, yeah. You know, is Beyonce's fabulously glamorized and loads of dancers and so forth. Bruce Springsteen is fabulously glamorized
oh,
in a
yeah.
very different way.
Different way.
You know,
but the same amount of thought goes into that.
It's did you read, there was yeah. a huge piece in the, I think it was in the New Yorker or New York Magazine before he went on tour a few years ago, and the journalist got to sit on the rehearsals, and even the kind of ad-libs to the crowd were scripted. He was practicing yeah. all that stuff.
Well, oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm afraid to say Brian Wilson. I once stood behind him quite recently, and he has these things that look like monitors either side yeah. of his keyboard. And they're actually scrolling auto cues telling him what to say. I mean, so you know, there's not a lot of spontaneity.
I remember,
there.
I don't want to make everything about the Beatles, but I remember seeing McCartney I was working at the Isle of Wight Festival a few years ago, and he was playing, and there was this one moment in the concert where he played three or four songs and then he took his jacket off and he's just standing there, he's got braces on and he's just sort of taking it in, he's looking at this sea of people, I don't know, 50, 60,000 whatever it was, and he says, God, I just want to take this in for a minute actually, and the crowd are going nuts. Thank God, to think that you're at that stage in your career and during a performance you can be overwhelmed like that. About a week later, he did a gig in Hyde Park. Exact same part of the show.
I've got to take
Toad
a moment
comes
here.
Off. Yeah, and he's like,
comes off.
Just going to take a moment.
Take a
here. Yeah.
But you see, if you went to see a comedian, you'd completely accept.
Yeah, they would do the same material every night.
No, it's a great bit of theatrics. Is it? Barbara Streisand, I think, has her tour manager. I think we might have talked about this before. Whichever city she's playing in, the tour manager has to find out the name of the best restaurant in town.
Yeah.
And the best dish on the menu. So that is a certain part of the gig. She's there on the auto queue. Well, it's great to be here in Manchester. I had a fantastic meal at Topper Gigio's earlier on. I mean, yeah. Isn't that linguine fantastic?
That's great. Yeah. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
And people are convinced by this.
Yeah, yeah.
Astonishing. Well, look, on the subject of Dylan having someone to sing his songs for him, our next theory is a Jude Rogers theory. And it is that the best pop singers can't sing. Elaborate.
So this is an argument I've had for a long time with Eamon Ford, who Word Magazine readers and podcast listeners may remember. Northern Irish accent's quite hard to understand. You have to zone into Eamon. We always argue about this, particularly with Neil Tennant, or the Pet Shop Boys there, about how, you know... I don't get it, why you like the Pet Shop Boys so much. He just can't sing. He can be out of tune. His voice wavers, all this stuff. Admittedly, his voice has improved over the years, and he has had singing lessons latterly. When I interviewed them once, he was talking about that. But I think my favourite pop singers, I've realised, are the people who make mistakes quite often or are really trying to do something but don't quite get it right. You know, that's what character is. I think the first pop song that really, really moved me when I was little was Suburbia by the Pet Shop Boys. You know, I knew my mum would play the Beatles and I knew other songs, but I remember watching Top of the Pops and they did Suburbia on it. And just, you know, that was a song he actually does sing most of, because obviously you have West End Girls and he's doing this sort of spoken word, you know, slightly rap-influenced, you know, throwing together different ideas. But he's actually singing, you know, and that chorus, Let's Take a Ride Down the Dogs, are in Suburbia, and it kind of wavers a bit and it goes all over the place. But it speaks of that kind of suburban environment that made me think a little bit. You know, I was a very earnest kind of book-reading kid, and it really spoke to me about the kind of environment I was from, where I lived. And ever since, you know, his voice is not classically beautiful, but it's just so amazingly characterful. Somebody I've always liked as well is Sarah Cracknell from St Etienne. Quite often, she can't hit the notes, you know. But when she first came along and sang with St Etienne, you have songs like Nothing Can Stop Us Now, and she's singing, you know, I've never felt so good, I've never felt so strong, and her voice is not quite getting the note, but it's almost like a... You were, you know, the ordinary person in your bedroom wanted to be, you know, she looks nice. She's very beautiful, very glamorous. but there's that element of ordinariness about it.
But that makes it unthreatening. It makes it, well, I could sing. If she can sing, I could sing.
But pop music, you know, I've always said it's about, you know, I'm managing to get the extraordinary out of very ordinary situations or people from very ordinary backgrounds. You know, she's not particularly from an ordinary background, but Senetti and kind of, you know, Bob Stanley and Pete Wiggs are from Croydon. They're quite ordinary suburban blokes. You know, I'm sure this is a Mark Ellen theory that might have been. It was a Word magazine office theory anyway, about the best bands live just that little bit too far from the big city, so you've got to go in, so it's just that far away. You know, Neil Tennant's from the northeast, and you know, when I remember finding out where Neil Tennant was from, like about 3 or 4 was it to love the Petrol Boys, going, he's not from there, you know, kind of, because he just seems this very different, larger than life character. But you know, there's some other brilliant pop singers, you know, Shane McGowan, he can't stand up half the time, you know, he's got a very characterful voice. But Bernard Sumner as well, you know, one of my favourite songs is by them is Your Silent Face, which is a song that, you know, it's not about his voice and about his delivery. Well, it is, but it is.
I've scribbled a few down here.
Oh, go on.
People who can't sing in a bad way. Keith Richards, Madonna, Mick Jones of The Clash, Pete Wiley. Sorry.
Yes.
People who can't sing, but in a good way. Shane McGowan, I totally agree with you. Jonathan Richman.
Yes.
Beefheart and Tom Waits, who actually are an act, but they're a kind of non-singing act. But there's no... people who have an ordinariness. Kelly Willis and Carole King. Carole King has an ordinary. She's not a spectacular... Mm. There's a whole raft of people who can sing, but they sing in an incredibly technical way, where all you can do is admire them. Beyonce, Whitney Houston, Rufus Wainwright, Annie Lennox, people who just... They're not really very moving, but you just think, well, they clearly can sing. And the
Rufus
last
Wainwright
think,
is the classic case.
Really?
Yeah.
His father, lovable voice. Rufus, better voice, not lovable.
No.
Martha,
his sister, much better, more character.
Yeah.
There's a David Byrne quote about the better, the technically better the voice, the more difficult it is to believe it.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah. Because you get to the point where all you're doing is just admiring a performance.
Yeah.
You know? I think there are just a few singers who really can sing, but are also incredibly moving. Joni Mitchell's one, I think. Amy Winehouse. Jeff Buckley, I think. You know, really can sing, but fantastic.
Did you tweet me the other night, Mark?
No, and he's real. He's for real as well.
Well, again, going back to Jude's point about Jeff Buckley, when she was in touch with him today, was Jeff Buckley overrated? Yes. And I was one of the people who overrated
him. It's all your fault.
You were one of the very few people who ever interviewed him.
No, but I did overrate him like Matt.
Yeah.
Oh,
no,
you did. That's
I
what
haven't
happened.
Been able to listen to it for 10
years. We all get excited, don't we?
Yeah.
I think, basically, in this the culture we live in now, which, you know, I know X Factor doesn't have the power that it has, that it used to have in society like 10 years ago. You know, this idea that, you know, a singer goes up on stage, and this idea that if they hit a high note... And I'm not talking about like Bill Withers in Lovely Day, which is amazing, but just like I can do this melisma and I can hold this note for it's just clapping. It's like somebody winning the 100-meter sprint or something.
Acrobatics.
Yeah.
It is. We have, I think, a couple more theories here, if I can get this to work.
Oh.
And this is a Dave Hepburn. You shouldn't play pop songs.
This is mine. And I could be in danger of upsetting people here, actually.
I don't agree with this.
Okay, well, that's fine. And it's, you know, I suppose my antipathy starts with, I think there's a picture of Elton John doing Candle in the Wind at Diana's funeral. And it struck me, loads of things, you know, that kind of, we're an increasingly secular society, obviously, but footballers have never been more likely to point at the sky when they score a goal nowadays, you know. So we have the kind of forms of religious observance with none of the basic matter, and I think what happens in the introduction of pop songs in funerals is you get one of the key features of pop music, which is individualism, introduced into a ceremony that really is not about individualism at all, you know, and. You know, I looked into the kind of cooperative funeral services list of the most requested songs at funerals nowadays, and of course it's things like "My Way," you know, or Robbie Williams' "Angels." Always look on the bright side of life, which is I remember seeing that at Graham Chapman's memorial service, and I thought that was amazing then, but now it's absolutely standard, everywhere. But My Way, the idea that you have My Way played at a funeral, because My Way is a song all about building up your part in life, hasn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's, I matter more than anybody yeah. else. Yeah. I have powers more than anybody else. And a funeral is all about saying, no, you don't, mate, because you're in the box. Yeah. And we're all out here, yeah. you know? And the idea of...
Also, it sounds like you're trying to change people's perception of you after well, the grave.
You then, you know, if you've chosen... And, I mean, there may be people in this room who've written down the piece of paper somewhere that they liked. They'd like, I don't know, Roy Harper's When an Old Cricketer Leaves the Crease. Played at their funeral. And I can't help but think that if you project forward to the funeral, which you won't be at, OK, there'll be at least a significant number of people in that church or place going, what the fuck is that? Are there, the other half are going to be going, oh, God, this is that thing he always wanted
to play
me
this
to...
all the time. He's still trying to make us like it. Now.
Absolutely.
It's too late.
That was the point. That was my point, you know, and I just think this can't go on, you know, at the rate that it's going at the moment because, you know, I went to all my parents and grandparents' generation's funeral, and Abide With Me was about as egotistical as it got. You know what I mean? And the message at those funerals was, we're all the same.
I definitely want a pop song, well, a rock song at my funeral. Sorry.
Go on. Have you decided what it is?
Yeah, I've thought about it. I'd like Atmosphere by Joy Division. And because I don't want it to be celebratory at all, my funeral, I want people to be really miserable.
Really sad
yeah.
that you've gone.
Yeah, 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 very much so. And even to the extent that I'd like druids carrying big black and white pictures on me, like in the Anton Corbijn band video. I mean, I just think, you know, just in case there's not enough grief, that might just pull some strings.
Right. It would be awful to look down from the clouds and see a whole lot of people having a brilliant time. Yeah, he's finally gone. You know. Yeah. Judy, is there a record that you've heard at a funeral that works? Or what
yes.
You think?
It's funny, because I sort of do agree with Dave. You know, and I think people, you just do think about these things these days, and hopefully it's a while off for me, but kind of, I thought of an instrumental piece of music I might like, but, you know, I've not put it in my will or anything. I've been to two funerals the last couple of years, which have changed my perception towards it, because I would have been with Dave, and I appreciate that lots of people aren't religious anymore, so that's might be why they don't want to abide with me, because it seems disingenuous, and I've been to funerals that are very religious, people weren't religious, and it always feels a bit peculiar. But I went to the funeral of my brother's mother-in-law, who had been ill for quite some time and knew she was dying and planned what she wanted to have with her daughters, who had looked after through a, you know, long illness. And I didn't know what it was going to be. We were at this funeral, you know, it was very sad. It was a long time coming. And her daughters brought her in. They wanted to carry the coffin in and all this kind of stuff. And then they played Together in Electric Dreams. And good God. It sounds weird. It sounds weird. But it's a song. If you listen to the lyrics, it is just... I can't even talk about it now. It was a song they because she really used to love...
Is this the Human League song?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. We'll always be together, however far it seems. Yeah. We'll always be together. It started, I was like, first of all, I did think, Dave, what the fuck is this? What's going on?
Yeah.
But then you listen to the lyrics, and it's a song that actually was helping her girls get through that day. Right. And that's, she wanted them to kind of feel that she was there with them then. I thought that was actually really touching. I can't hear, if it ever comes on now, I'm in floods of tears. It's, you know. But listen to the lyrics of that later. It's about... thinking, you know, I'm always with you.
Also, I would never be able to get over the shock of first hearing
it. Yeah, it was shocking.
And if Mark was anywhere near me, we'd be looking at each other going,
yeah. To be honest, I think...
Phil Oakey with his amazing long-term haircut. Not be
she wasn't either. A kind of person who had... You know, she wasn't like a big muso or anything like this. It was just a song that she liked and there weren't musos in the audience. It wasn't, you know, Word Magazine office there. It was really unexpected, but it was a moment between three women that they shared, and that was really lovely. I also went to the funeral recently of somebody who was a music journalist who died quite young, and it was a very small memorial service, and he'd written something he wanted to be read out, which was very touching and simple, and he was not somebody who would ever big himself up. And at the end of the funeral, they just played his favourite song, which was Pressure Drop by Toots and the Maytals, and it was lovely, because it's such a simple, joyous song. And it was just... a lovely moment at the end of it. And that didn't feel, this is weird.
So what are you having, Mark?
Oh, I'm heading for...
No, at your funeral, I wonder
that. At my funeral? Well, no, I don't know. The only song I've heard that really worked... I agree with you. I think most pop music, the problem is that, you know, I've heard In My Life by the Beatles, I've heard Alleluia by Jeff Buckley. Neither of those work at all. No. They don't work, mainly because they're songs about romances, actually, and that becomes kind of embarrassing and it's awkward. The only song I've ever heard that really worked, actually, which is it's going to sound a bit pretentious, but it was a French song by Charles Trenet called La Mer.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know La Mer? You know, see how many words I know. I've run out after La Mer. I've run out. And I think it's really, really good because it's in French and therefore most people can't understand it. And even if they could understand it, it's actually a very happy song about Trenet looking out the window of a train. And looking at the sea and the sky and seeing how they meet up.
So you're having La Mer, are you?
I think I'm going to have La Mer.
Yeah,
I have to say, when Mark and I, if either of us goes to a funeral, a memorial service, we always report back to each other afterwards what the entertainment was like and so forth. And at the end, we always say the same thing, can't wait for yours.
Yeah, bring it on. Brilliant.
Now we know.
Now we know. We've got two to go. Jeff's theory is that all live albums are rubbish.
Kind of.
Slightly
condensed version of the
Already
theory.
He's having second thought.
No. what my actual theory is that the handful of good live albums like Folsom Prison or The Who Live at Leeds don't cancel out just how bad most live recordings are. And I say this from the perspective of somebody who every year would have to play out the best of that year's festival season on the radio. And they were just sort of terrible versions. Like even legendary bands like Fleetwood Mac or whoever, they'd be like really ropey, poorly sung versions. They wouldn't be tidied up. And not in a charming way either, just in a real raggedy, messy way. And I don't think anybody was thinking, oh, I really like hearing this rather than the version that I know.
Very rarely.
The applause doesn't... I think there are some good live albums. I mean, obviously, you know, the Keith Jarrett Colne concert, like, that's a brilliant example of a live recording. But on balance, there are so many bad ones, they're usually just ways of artists fulfilling a contractual obligation that I think...
Or preying upon the completists who absolutely have to have everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, even that Nirvana Unplugged album, which I really like the versions on that album, but I could do without audience applause. That doesn't add anything to it for me. So that's my theory.
I was going to say about The Last Waltz, and because I was thinking of this when the Staple Singers come onto the Wait. But I was reading about that earlier today, and it was overdubbed. I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, I was just like, you know,
nothing is real.
Nothing is real, man. Yeah. I was shocked.
That happens all the time. At the radio station I work for, they some huge sort of world famous band, they sent somebody off to record a concert of theirs somewhere elsewhere in Europe, and the recording was so bad that the producer, as an act of kindness, went and took it into a studio and played piano over the top of it because the front man was doing such a lousy job of playing and singing at the same time on stage, because, you know, he's putting on a show. And even the Beatles at Shea Stadium, if you've heard that, I mean, that wasn't recorded at Shea Stadium.
No.
It was done in a studio in Wembley or somewhere.
It does break my heart.
In defence of live albums, they provide an enormous amount of excitement for about 2 days after you buy them. Because you tend to buy them when you're 18, 19 or whatever, and it's your favourite group. And they finally recorded it. So you can do, which is the thing that really keeps rock and roll going, which is 18-year-old boys going into rooms, pulling the curtains and pretending to be... to be the singer or whatever.
I mean, Bob Marley's live album at the Lyceum was pretty much made his career then, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's an amazing...
But I'm not saying there aren't exceptions.
Yeah.
Can I just say one thing about Live at Leeds? Somebody was telling me recently, if you're familiar with that record, they made it a facsimile of a bootleg with kind of contracts and letters inside. And somebody was telling me that they bought a copy in whenever it came out, 1970, I think, and looked inside and thought, oh, my God, they've included these by mistake. So wrote to the record company and said, we're giving you your documents back because you've put them inside my
copy
of Live at Leeds. That's how people were in those days.
That's wonderful.
But I think it's not a bad point, Jeff, at all. It's not a bad point.
No, it's fair. And we're back to...
Finally.
The last one, which, again, Dave writes about very entertainingly in his book, which is that... And I've had some experience with this recently, which I might mention, because I had to DJ at a wedding with my eldest son. But you're saying you can only play dead certs at a wedding disco.
Yeah, well, go because on. I think if you're called upon to play records for a group of people, like such as might be found at the wedding, who are, you know, from all kinds of places, the temptation to slip in something intriguing should always, always, always be resisted.
Yeah.
And the more you know about popular music, the more you feel that temptation, yeah. You know? And so my view about wedding discos, you know, they're a very emotional occasion, made more emotion by the presence of alcohol and, you know, two families who don't know each other. So if anything's going to kick off, it'll kick off at a wedding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think as you look out...
You've been to weddings where there have been fights or something, Dave.
As you look out, I think there are three constituencies at a wedding. There are the kind of the young men who are looking sneeringly at the DJ and wondering who he or she is going to be up to it. There are the young women who are getting round the Prosecco and so forth. And then there are the kind of the great middle-aged anonymous
men. Uncles and aunts.
Uncles and aunts, yeah, and absolutely folks. Everybody else. And my view is don't try and please the first group because you won't win.
Yeah.
Don't try and please the second group because you won't win. Please the third group. If you can get the middle-aged onto the dance floor, the women will launch in there as well. Yeah. And once the women are there, the blokes will inevitably follow after. So it's dead certs of wedding discos, is my view.
Give us some of the songs that you think never fail.
It's things like Dancing Queen. It's things like House of Pain, you know, Jump Around.
Yeah.
It's Dancing in the Dark by Bruce Springsteen. It's Jean Genie. It's stuff, blindingly obvious stuff like that is what works. But never submit to the temptation to chuck in anything intriguing.
Which, Jeff, you may have done, because you said earlier on that you had a terrible experience DJing at a wedding.
I was a mobile DJ for a while, and it would often go poorly for me. And it was usually when people... usually when people sort of prescribed what they wanted to hear. So this was the early 90s, and a lot of people would say, oh, you know, can you... you play Pixies or whatever it would be, which I would be happy to play. But it's that exact same thing. Your auntie's not going to dance to it. No. And then, you know, when you play that music, it sort of clears everybody off the dance floor. You and your mates from school might be dancing to it, but that's only sort of four or five people. And then you're angry at the DJ because you think they're doing a bad job.
Yes.
Because the worst one I ever had, and I've sort of tried for the best, well, more than two decades now to work out what happened. I did this one disco at Macclesfield Liberal Club, which is a horrible venue because it was lots of stairs for getting your kit up. And nobody danced all night. And like, I was trying all, you know, the big hitters, like the sort of things you've just named or things from Grease or Stevie Wonder, Superstition. And nobody was dancing to anything. And then... I don't know why or what inspired. I put on REM, Losing My Religion. The dance floor filled up every generation. And, you know, this wasn't quite the standard that it is now, Losing My Religion. It was a bit newer at the time. So I thought, okay, I'll follow it with something similar. I forget what it would have been, Crowded House or whatever they were playing on the radio alongside REM at the time. Dance floor emptied. Nobody else danced all night. I mean, I tried everything, and that was the only record that people danced to. And at the end of the evening, I was so embarrassed that I squatted down on the floor behind my DJ desk and listened for the room to empty before I stood up because I couldn't look any of those guests in the eye.
Yeah. Did you think you were on candid camera?
It was like the strangest thing. That's like, really why that record? I mean, it's not even a great song to dance to.
No, it's really quite slow.
Yeah. Gee, what experience have you had of records that work?
Records that work, Heatwave, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas.
Yeah.
When I got married, our first song was, you know, something deeply pretentious that meant something to us, and nobody danced to it, but it was really short. We just did this a bit awkwardly, and then put on Heatwave, and it was like,
yeah.
Motown, works. Yeah. Beatles don't work.
No, Beatles don't work.
ABBA works. Something
Waterloo
else.
By ABBA's the one.
Waterloo's good.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I didn't Lay All Your Love on Me works as well. Yeah. Kids in America is a great one because that gets my mum will only usually dance when she's had three glasses of wine and a gin and tonic, but she will dance to Kids in America. But Kids in America always crowds it. But I always find that, you know, the later you go in the evening, if the parents have, you know, they've gone home or whatever, you know, you put on stuff that's, you know, for, you know, people in their 40s to 50s, you know, you Push It by Salt and Pepper, which you played.
Push It
you?
By Salt and Pepper, I just want to make the point that I played Push It by Salt and Pepper at a recent wedding, so that should make me impossibly cool.
At my wedding, a really weird one that some of my friends played, this was very near the end of the evening, it was when we were going home, Dan and I were leaving, and there weren't many people left, but they played Being Boring by the Pet Shop Boys, a very strange song to play at a wedding, but it was actually really perfect when we were leaving. It's, you know, a song about, you know, long friendships and all this kind of stuff. I think, to be honest, my friends were DJing at that point just had given up. And were like, I'll put that on. Jude likes that. But that was actually really lovely. But it's very dependent on the crowd. But Motown, always.
Yeah. I hear your Motown. I want to raise you Twisting the Night Away by Sam Cooke.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely classic. I might also say that Maybelline by Chuck Berry is great. The only problem is it's Maybelline, Why Can't You Be True, which is sort of not quite right for a wedding disco,
that,
but still.
I don't think that matters,
Heatwave,
after
definitely.
After the first dance, it doesn't matter.
And my well, you know, son the song is DJ people... Pals to talk about Tainted Love, Hey Ya
by
Crazy In Love by Beyonce, any big Stevie Wonder, The Love Cats by The Cure.
Yes.
Huge success. People love it. It can be slightly ironic. You know, people who don't really dance can dance to it. You know, Get Down On It by Kool & the Gang. Walk This Way, 1999 by Prince.
Oh, my God.
And I
Want to
Dance
again.
With Somebody, but I know. But
can I just throw in one thing you should never play at a wedding and people do?
Atmosphere by Joy Division.
No. No, they play in the ceremony or for the first dance is When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge. Yeah. Because if you listen to the lyrics, it's all about how you should never marry a woman who cheats on you.
Yeah.
And so the couple, you know, trundling around to the first time, don't realise what it is that they're
isn't that true
supposedly
every
celebrating.
Breath you take, but
every one, breath. Exactly
the same one thing. I love at REM, which I have seen as a first dance at a wedding.
That's fantastic. Lots of things to avoid.
Yeah. All this wisdom and entertainment it can be found, this erudition, and then to say, can be found in Dave's book, which is absolutely stupendous, I have to say. And it's called Nothing Is Real, and I believe it's out around now.
It is.
It is out.
It is, Mark.
It's available. It is available. And I think my job now is simply to thank the great Jeff Lloyd, the great Jude Rogers,
thank
David Hepworth. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word. You've been listening to The Word podcast. If you've enjoyed it, we would really appreciate it if you would take the time to rate it on iTunes. You can find many more Word podcasts at wordpodcast.co.uk. And if you'd like to come to one of our Word in Your Ear live events, then you can find details at wiyelondon.com or just Google us.